want oil, we want gas. Watch out, world, we'll kick your ass.
But is George Bush a moron? Well, it's interesting to think about. He looks like a president, he acts like a president, but he says very dumb things.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He has been described as the best foreign minister President Bush ever had.
It's great to know that the women's inspectors are actually there, but people are very nervous that this process is somehow going to be short-circuited by the U.S.
The Bush administration would like to lead us to believe that this is a war to take out Saddam. If we go to war, it doesn't take out Saddam, it takes out innocent civilians.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, November 25th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The FBI has announced it's investigating whether the Saudi government funded two students who allegedly took part in the September 11th attacks in the U.S. An article in the latest issue of Newsweek titled The Saudi Money Trail links checks from the Saudi royal family's account to rent payments for the alleged 911 hijackers. Professor Asad Abu Khalil is an expert on Middle Eastern affairs at the University of California. He says the Newsweek article, the leak, is timely.
Well, I think that everybody in this story has some ulterior motives. I don't think that the leak to Newsweek in the article by Michael Isikoff is innocent in many ways. I view the leak because the government has sat on this information for a while now. They've known about the funding, and they have not reacted to it. Its leak is timed, in my opinion, to the prepared war on Iraq. They are putting pressure on the Saudi government so that they'll be more forthcoming in providing the use of the advanced Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia to be used in the war on Iraq. We also have to say that this particular story, it seems to me, is not very persuasive. It is certainly true that the royal family buys off support, and they provide a lot of money for charity work and other works they support. And in that work they do, some money may wind up with somebody else's, and that's what happened. The wife of the ambassador gave money to a sick, ill woman who gave the money to another person, and that person in turn gave it to two hijackers that he befriended, although there's no evidence that he in any way knew about what they were doing. And this is what the story is really about. What is very, what I find very hypocritical on the part of Congress in their campaign against Saudi Arabia is this. One, if they are worried about Saudi Arabia's human rights violation, which are really abysmal, how come they haven't spoken about it all these years? For the last 60 years, the royal family has been abusing human rights violation, and yet they didn't say a word about it. Secondly, if they are interested in pointing fingers at those who are guilty of funding and arming fundamentalist extremist Islam, they should point fingers at the royal family and also to the U.S. government, which hand in hand, in bed with the royal family, have funded and supported and armed militant fundamentalist Islam, from the ranks of whom came none other than bin Laden. Throughout the Cold War, the United States and Saudi Arabia were in an alliance against communism, socialism, feminism, and secularism in much of the Middle East. And I wonder whether those files will be opened. The answer is no. And that's why the White House continues to cover up the role of Saudi Arabia. It's too embarrassing a file to open.
Well, it sounds like on the one hand, you're saying the White House is trying to cover it up. On the other hand, you're saying they're trying to, this leak is not an accident, and they're trying to pressure Saudi Arabia to be a little bit more forthcoming.
Exactly. You see, the United States government today operate in the Middle East on the basis of the Hamid, what I call the Hamid Karzai rule, according to which the United States will only allow for 100% loyalty and subservience, the likes of which is being presented today by Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan. There is no disagreement, no criticism. The Saudi royal family is in a bind. On the one hand, they have to please America. On the other hand, they have to please their own people. But those two aims are contradictory. The more you please America, the more you upset your people, because America is highly unpopular in much of the region. If you please your own people, of course, you displease the United States. So they are trying to please both, and they are doing a very bad job at doing it.
So what would be the motive on the part of the U.S. to try and, what are they trying to get Saudi Arabia to do at this point?
100% support report on America's endeavors and efforts in the Middle East, including on the war on Iraq.
But haven't they been cooperative with the U.S.?
On the war on Iraq, they have had many criticism, because not because of any humanitarian reasons, but because they know how widely unpopular the war in Iraq is and will be, especially as Palestinian suffering continue to mount with U.S. indulgence of Israeli violent actions against the Palestinians.
So who do you think leaked this information to Newsweek?
It's hard to tell. My own guess would be somebody probably in the warmongering camp within the Pentagon. But it's hard to tell. Mm-hmm. That's my guess.
And so the senator that is leading this charge...
There are many. There's Schumer, there's Lieberman, there's Graham. There's a whole chorus in Congress.
So the names that you just named of the senators that are leading this charge in the Senate, their interest would be what? To try and expose the links between Saudi Arabia and Al-Qaeda?
Twofold. One, they want Saudi Arabia to become more forthcoming in the war on Iraq. And two, and that's very important for people like Schumer, they want Saudi Arabia to become more forthcoming in accepting American dictates in the region by signing a peace treaty with Israel and putting more pressure on the Palestinians, something the royal family cannot do because it is widely unpopular inside the country.
So let's talk a little bit about the actual links between the royal family and Al-Qaeda. You think that this was just an accident, that this money ended up supporting this Al-Qaeda representative, that there are no real links between this family?
No. I was only speaking to the specific link. It sounds to me innocent enough about money went to an ill woman who gave it to a man who in turn helped two Saudi students, the involvement of whom with Al-Qaeda he was totally unaware of. This is not to say that in the past there may not have been money that went to Al-Qaeda directly or indirectly. But in that, Saudi Arabia was not on its own. It was with America. This all goes back to the Cold War, and especially to the 1980s, when Saudi Arabia and the United States and Pakistani intelligence began an umbrella organization from the ranks of which came Bin Laden. So if Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda got money and weapons over the years, they got them from Saudi Arabia and the United States. They were working hand in hand in the same trench. And according to The Economist magazine of last year, the CIA maintained contacts with Bin Laden up until 1994.
Professor Asad Abu Khalil is an expert on Middle Eastern affairs at the University of California. He believes Saudi Arabia will now change course and provide unconditional military support and use of the airbase for U.S. troops. A peace vigil and hunger strike by the women's group Code Pink continues into its second week in front of the White House. The demonstrators turned their attention to domestic affairs today, reacting to the signing of the Homeland Security Bill. Among them was Zakiya Habi, an Iraqi-American who was the first elected female judge in Iraq. Before September 11th, Habi's two sons were jailed in the United States on the basis of secret evidence which neither they nor their attorneys were allowed to see. It turned out the U.S. authorities had made a mistake in identifying the name of a town in Syria called Kabul, thinking the men were terrorists from the city in Afghanistan called Kabul. Habi's sons were released, but only after 4 years in prison. Habi is concerned the U.S. government is trampling Americans' civil rights in the name of protecting the homeland.
While my son's here behind bars for the unknown charge, we didn't know what's the charges because it's a secret. After they released the evidence, there was no case. There was no case. They said just they went to Kabul. Well, he said, I went to Khabur. You know, I really concerned for American security as an Iraqi-American citizen. I really concerned for that. But if they exaggerated this way, we will return back to the era of McCarthy. Yes, and just like Soviet Union. Yeah.
Save the Bill of Rights! Save the Bill of Rights! Save the Bill of Rights! Save the Bill of Rights!
This is a precious document that we have here. It's called the Bill of Rights, and it's something that we are here today to stand up for. And we know that there are some dark forces in this country that would like to see an end to the Bill of Rights. They sometimes wrap themselves in the flag while they shred the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So we are here today to protect ourselves from these dark forces and save this Bill of Rights.
Harriet Brown, I'm here to question your activities.
How do you know my name?
I know all of your names. I searched your apartment this morning.
How did you get into my apartment?
I don't need a warrant. I searched your apartment. I understand you're part of the subversive organization Women for Peace.
How do you know anything about me?
What? I've been reading your emails. I know your boyfriend's name is Mohammed. And some spicy emails at that.
You're reading my emails?
That's right.
I'm an American citizen.
You could easily be a terrorist. Your boyfriend's name is Mohammed. And what is this? This
promises the freedoms that an American citizen has been promised that they have.
This is a threat to our national security. This is a threat to our homeland. This must go.
Political theater in Lafayette Park across from the White House. As weapon inspectors return to Iraq, there is a sense that many are holding their breath as though waiting for the other shoe to drop. There is an overwhelming sense that UN Resolution 1441 calls for Iraq to list all biological and chemical agents for any purpose is a recipe for failure. We spoke with Jim Paul of the Global Policy Institute in New York today.
Around here at the UN, there's a certain sense of relief, but also at the same time, people are very nervous that this process is somehow going to be short-circuited by the U.S., and that particularly has to do with the weapons list that's due on the 8th of December.
When you say short-circuited by the U.S., I'm assuming you mean that the fear is that the U.S. will attempt to try and use the lack of that information as a trigger for war?
That certainly is one possible scenario. There's a strong sense by many that the U.S. Really doesn't want to see an inspection process go forward, that war is on the agenda, that there's a lot of evidence out there that the U.S. is continuing to build up his forces, to line up various other countries in some kind of a alliance for this war, that, in short, the bulldozer is rolling. And on the other hand, inspectors on the ground offer a small glimmer of hope that maybe there can be inspections.
So when you say that there is a list due on the 8th of December, that could actually prove problematic to this entire process. Can you expound on that? Exactly what is it that the Iraqis will be required to provide at that time?
Well, the interesting thing here is that it's not clear how much information is supposed to be on that list. The hardliners in Washington are saying that that list must include every single type of chemical or biological agent that is produced in Iraq for any purpose. And so therefore, obviously, it would go way beyond the issue of prohibited weapons themselves. Naturally, there's somewhat of a gray area between what is, a civilian purpose and what is a military purpose here, but a list that includes absolutely everything is a very big list indeed. And so my understanding is that the Iraqis are uncertain what the Resolution 1441 requires of them, and no one quite knows what is supposed to be on this list.
Well, it does indeed sound like a major problem if the Iraqis are expected to produce a list and no one is quite certain what's supposed to be on the list.
Well, that's just it. I mean, they've said they're uncertain. I'm not sure what Hans Blix has been instructed to tell them on this. One could imagine various scenarios, one of which would be that the Iraqis would produce the list with on a very basis of a very broad construction, and then the U.S. would say, you see all those weapons that they've just announced they have, therefore, they're and they still have weapons, therefore we need to go to war. I mean, it is in this particular environment where the U.S. seems so keen on moving towards war, everyone is kind of tiptoeing around and worried that one false step, even completely unintended, will lead directly to the battlefield.
Well, it could be a possible trigger, but now there are steps that are supposed to be taken prior to the battlefield, before the bombs drop, are there not, as a result of this resolution? If it is determined that there are weapons, isn't the idea that Iraq is supposed to be disarmed before you go to the bombing stage?
Well, there's a lot of ambiguity in the UN process, and I think that ambiguity was intended to be there not only to get the resolution, but that some of the U.S. needed to allow certain ambiguity in there so that other members of the Security Council could sign off on Resolution 1441. But I think that some of the members of the Council, perhaps the majority, were at some level aware that probably this thing is going to go to war, and they want to have a certain amount of deniability here. It's hard to say exactly what was playing out in the thinking of the various different governments, but I think it's clear that there's massive amounts of ambiguity, and that the United States intends to use that ambiguity to reach the policy goals that they're seeking. So, this ambiguity about the list is a very curious one. I mean, I was astonished to see how agitated people got when even asked what the, let's say, the legislative history of it was. In terms of legislative history, there were many statements made at the time when Resolution 1441 was passed, and those are interesting to see. It's clear that most of the countries on the Security Council did have a different view of what it all meant than the U.S., and they expect that the matter, first of all, that proportionality would have to be used. A number of them made statements about proportionality. And in international law, proportionality in a situation like this means that if inspectors are delayed by 1 hour from getting into a place for some reason we don't quite know, that the proportional response to that shouldn't be the same as if, let's say, Iraq kicks all the inspectors out of the country and says, ha ha, we don't want to have any inspectors anymore. I mean, there has to be all kinds of proportions there, and that's what the Security Council should be itself deciding. That's what they said. However, the United States has made many, many comments about how it doesn't want to be, quote, handcuffed by the Security Council resolution, that It will agree to a second meeting of the council to examine any problems that may arise, but that won't be in any way binding on the United States. So you see there's quite a wide range of views, especially between the United States and the rest of the council members, on what happens in the case of some violation, small or large.
Jim Paul is with the Global Policy Institute, an independent UN watch group. The skies in Iraq were blue and unusually clear today upon the arrival of the weapons inspectors. Iraqis are observing the holy month of Ramadan under the Muslim faith. There's a feeling of anticipation in the air, according to Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices in the Wilderness, who's living in Baghdad and working with the Iraq peace team. We spoke with Kelly earlier today, and she says the average Iraqi is aware of the inspector's arrival, and they're put off by reports some in the Bush administration are attempting to discredit head UN weapons inspector Hans von Blix.
When Mr. Blix held a press conference and some word came that there were people in the United States, including Mr. Wolfowitz and Mr. Cheney, who felt that even if Mr. Blix was competent in their view, they thought that his task was impossible, that it wouldn't be possible to discover all of the weapons that Iraq might have. One woman commented, why do they want to take away our hope?
What did she mean by that?
I think she meant that, you know, people are feeling some hope that a weapons inspection could happen and there could be some certification that the weapons inspectors in due time would be satisfied and that, you know, maybe that would lead to a lifting of the sanctions.
Have you seen any visible signs that the Iraqi government is getting ready for the inspectors?
In terms of readiness for the inspections, I only know that a special commission has been formed of Iraqis who are to be from the Iraqi side in cooperation with the inspectors, that group has formed up.
Now, is Voices in the Wilderness planning any sort of specific action around the presence of the inspectors being there? Does that influence your work at all, one way or the other?
Well, we know that it's, in a way, preparing, as an analogy, preparing essay answers to questions that often aren't on the test, but we still feel quite insistent about the awareness that we have that one of the major weapons of mass destruction here has in fact been the effects, the consequences of the economic sanctions, and that even though quite often in mainstream media reporting we'll hear that the Iraqi government issues statistics claiming that there have been civilian consequences of suffering and death due to the sanctions, in fact those have been reports that have come from the United Nations as well. Now, the United Nations statistics may be lower than those which are issued by the Iraqi government and the health ministry, but certainly the 1999 situation analysis of women and children and the 2002 February report of UNICEF and many other reports have indicated that the United Nations says that the economic sanctions have cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. And when you look at just the statistics referring to children under age 5, well over 500,000 children under age 5. So we still feel that that's a very important point to make and that, in fact, the idea of containment is a code word for economic sanctions. So we still continue to be perhaps obstinate, but we think in a positive way in wanting to make that point.
It's likely that the Bush administration would respond to the conditions there that the Iraqi people are living in. The Bush administration would respond by saying that much of this hardship is brought on the Iraqi people as a result of the actions of their president, Saddam Hussein. What's your feeling about
that? Well, I know that that's been a very convenient talking point on the part of the Bush administration, but it simply doesn't cohere with United Nations reports that have shown again and again that the effects of the economic sanctions have been such that even though the government of Iraq has accomplished very effective distribution of the ration baskets such that it's their distribution plan is even recommended to other countries and it gets A-plus ratings, there's an extremely good article on this by Joy Gordon in this month's Harper magazine called Cool War. And she was able to get documents from the United Nations officials, and she did a careful analysis of the effects of the 661 Committee's delays primarily imposed by the United States on goods coming into the country, and she was able to trace what the consequences of those delays have been. And there's no avoiding the reality that this has been an intentional imposition of suffering on civilians caused by the U.S. role in manipulation of the 661 Committee.
Kathy Kelly and two other members of Voices in the Wilderness have been fined $10,000 by the U.S. Treasury Department for violating the U.S. sanctions imposed against Iraq by entering the country and taking medicine and supplies to help the Iraqi children. Kelly says Voices in the Wilderness believes the U.S. imposed sanctions are a crime against humanity. The British government is facing legal action over a possible invasion of Iraq. The influential Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament has given British Prime Minister Tony Blair 7 days to provide a written guarantee that the UK will not attack without explicit United Nations backings. Charlotte Parsons reports from London.
We have made our choice. Disarmament through the United Nations with force as a last resort. Saddam must now make his choice. And my message to him is this. Disarm or you face force. There must be no more games, no more deceit, no more prevarication, obstruction, or defiance. Cooperate fully, and despite the terrible injustices you have often perpetrated on others, we will be just with you. but defy the United Nations' will, and we will disarm you by force. Be under no doubt whatever of that.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He has been described as the best foreign minister President Bush ever had. Since the American government declared its war on terror, the Blair administration has been right behind it. Whether it's fighting Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan or Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Prime Minister Blair has been there, rallying public opinion, British troops, and international support. Never has the so-called special relationship between the two countries seemed quite so special. But now the British leader finds himself faced with legal action over his threats to attack Iraq. The Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, or CND, has served papers on Mr. Blair and two senior members of his cabinet. The CND's Ian Martin says his organisation is prepared to take the Prime Minister to court.
The formal deadline we've set is 4 p.m. Tuesday. If our lawyers are not satisfied that they've met the requirements, then our lawyer will lead the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament to serve papers on the government at the High Court in London. And that will be an important event. That will be the first time citizens of the United Kingdom have taken the government to court.
The legal letter demanded a written guarantee that the UK will not invade Iraq without the UN's permission. Lawyers for the group claim Britain would violate international law if it attacked without a further resolution.
Resolution must be found through diplomacy and all peaceful means. The United Nations, in our view, and the view of our lawyers, who have researched it thoroughly and put it in the legal framework which has been put to the government, is that it cannot be used as a fig leaf in order to just bolster public support and to give legitimacy to an invasion.
The CND is not some radical fringe group badly organised and easily dismissed. Many members of Blair's Labour Party cabinet were once members. One of them still is. And CND has some powerful legal muscle behind it. Matrix Chambers, a top human rights law firm, laid out the peace group's case against the government. And this particular law firm could hardly be accused of anti-government bias. The British Prime Minister's wife, Sherry Blair, is a lawyer there. Britain was at the forefront of efforts to hammer out a new UN resolution demanding the disarmament of Iraq. But Tony Blair has refused to rule out joining a unilateral US invasion if Iraq fails to meet the UN's terms.
America's goal, the world's goal, is more than the return of inspectors to Iraq. Our goal is to secure the peace through the comprehensive and verified disarmament of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Voluntary or by force, that goal will be achieved.
President Bush is not a popular man in Britain. Newspapers branded Mr. Blair a poodle for following the president, and leading academics have warned that the relationship between the two leaders could ultimately cost Mr. Blair his job. Said one, "It would be a shame if Tony Blair were brought down by playing poodle to this unelected and deeply stupid little oil spiv." That quote ran on the front page of The Guardian, one of Britain's leading newspapers. Nor is there public support for an attack on Iraq. 400,000 people took to the streets in protest at a recent anti-war rally. It was Britain's largest ever peacetime demonstration. Ian Martin says the low level of support is remarkable given government warnings of a possible terrorist attack on the nation's subway system.
There's a support from no more than a third of the British population. Less than a third, 31%. Less than a third of the country, despite the enormous propaganda. We have to remember, in times of preparation for war, you have to sift carefully what's being produced by the government offices of information. I mean, I don't believe for a moment that the announcement of threats of gas attack were anything but deliberate propaganda.
Legal action in a British court could not prevent US-led military action in Iraq. The US is also unlikely to recognise the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice in The Hague. But court action by CND could cause serious embarrassment to the UK government, which already has concerns about the legality of forcing Iraq to undergo regime change. CND has also warned that war with Iraq could escalate into a nuclear conflict. Earlier this year, British Defence Secretary Geoff Hoon fueled those fears when he said the UK was willing to use nuclear weapons in response to a chemical or biological attack.
The American military have wanted to test out their weapons in successive wars, right from the Second World War. And we fear that, as the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, we don't want to wait for a mushroom cloud over Iraq to turn round to the British government to say, we were right.
For Peace Watch, I'm Charlotte Parsons in London.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.